afternoon, we're going to begin so we can begin on time and end on time. Thank you very much for coming. This is a particularly important Dean's Corner because we're going to be talking about our strategic intentions that have come out of an extensive ground-up planning process that all of you, I think almost everybody in this room and those coming from a distance have participated in. And so I'll be going over the very large strategic intentions and those many that are low-hanging fruit sorts of things that are much more task-oriented we'll be dealing with at a subsequent Dean's Corner meeting. At the next Dean's Corner meeting, we've asked the provost to come. We realized last Friday when he came to talk to the Library Council that because our organization is so diverse that we really need him to come and present to everyone. And he's going to be, he opened up the meeting with a lot of questions about the budget. It's basically a budget presentation that he goes around and talks to many, many constituencies throughout the university. And so we felt that it was appropriate for you to hear him directly and not filtered through us. So we will be asking him to come to the next Dean's Corner. Just a few opening remarks. The winter's long this year and cold, but I, for one, am looking forward to spring. It will come, I think, the middle of March. I hope. It's time. I'm done with it. I'm done. Whether it decides to agree with me or not, I don't know. But in any case, it has been a long winter, and we have been very, very busy. We have been working on the strategic intentions document. Librarians have been working on their annual reports. We're about to enter into a merit process that is on track. It's important that all of those little bits of the annual review process are completed on time. So those of you who haven't quite finished everything, I encourage you to finish all of that up. I'm also in the process of finishing up a review of where we stand with the budget as a whole. And we're about to start a planning process for next year's budget because the fiscal year here starts May the 1st, so we'll be engaging in that very quickly. And that's why getting our strategic intentions kind of straight allows us when we have to make very, very serious concrete decisions and where we put our money that we know where we're going to put it. So with that, those are the main things that we're talking about today. So I'm going to start talking about strategic intentions here. This is what we have to look forward to pretty soon. About the middle of March, we will be going there. It may not look like that, the middle of March, but there's hope. So with the very, very first strategic intention, what we want to do is to make sure that we understand that what we want to be is an organization that recognizes that we exist for users. We don't exist for ourselves. We don't exist for any abstract notion. We exist because there are real users out there today and tomorrow, our students, researchers, staff, research associates, the public at large, who need our services, and we sometimes provide collections that satisfy their information needs, but if we don't have those information needs, we're the ones who can find them for anyone who needs them. You don't become a service and a user-focused organization by waving a magic wand and saying that this is what we're going to be. It takes dedicated thinking and a cultural transformation that has to be done consciously. There is there's a set of steps that have been verbalized by Sheldon Hess. That's his name, right? Sheldon, yeah, okay. That sort of march through and describe various states of an organization, particularly a library, in terms of developing a user focus. And so each one of our strategic, each one of our few large strategic intentions that we want to really develop over the next 1 to 3 year time span, which is the largest time span that we're dealing with. Any farther out than that, we don't think that we have a clear picture. We have designated an executive owner of that strategic intention, collaborators, those who are mainly involved in making it happen, some of the outcomes that we expect from this process, and how we are going to assess whether we have accomplished it or not. So with this first one, when we talk about what we mean in terms of growing the library as a user-centered organization that recognizes users as our primary motivator, and developing systematic methods for consulting our users on an ongoing basis as a matter of course by all library staff, whether you are directly working with the public or behind the scenes, what we want is to have as an expected outcome for this strategic initiative, what we say is a 4 in this series of steps in which you can sort of assess where we are as an organization in evolving to a very user-centric, user-focused organization. And number 4, I think that for those who are distant, the grid that I'm speaking from is available on the website. For those of you who are here, we have a few copies and you can refer to them. But I just want to read that number 4 is user experience as a primary motivator. Most staff members are comfortable with user experience thinking principles. Users are consulted regularly, not just for major decisions, but in an ongoing attempt at improvement. So anytime we think about what we're doing, we want to put ourselves in our users' shoes and say, what do they want? What do they really think? This goes to all sorts of questioning why we do things. It's a way of forcing ourselves to question things, from things as simple as, do we have food in the library? What do our users want? What's the greater good in that? Do we have obligations beyond the immediate need of what users want? In that very simple way. How do we accommodate their needs? How do we think outside the box? How do we make sure that they are comfortable enough to learn, to do research, to discover when you have something as basic a need as you're hungry? So issues just as simple as that, to recognizing that every first-year student who comes in here wants a box that they can put a few words in and search. You want a Google box, whether you think that's what they should have, whether you think that's the best way to get them to information, is really, that's one thing. We have to think in terms of what our users want, what from their perspective. It's a way of thinking that truly is important. It's a philosophy of librarianship and service that I have held for many, many, many years. Anyone who knows that the first run through of LibQual was my dissertation knows that this is my focus. And so this organization philosophically is right in step with that. So what we're doing is that we're actually verbalizing this major philosophy that we think needs to imbue everything that we do. Okay. The next, I just draw attention to, by the way, with the first strategic initiative, that we do have methods of assessment. Lori was very good at keeping us on track and just, you know, every once in a while saying, how are you going to assess that? How are we going to make sure that we've done that? And so we do have a column that says, this is not only what we're going to do, but this is who's responsible for it, this is who's involved in making it happen, And this is how we're going to assess that we've done what we said that we wanted to do in a rigorous way with a time frame. So you see that all of our major initiatives have that. Is this at North Carolina State?
Yeah.
Well, okay. So this is the sort of, this is actually a room in North Carolina State, the Hunt Library, that we keep talking about. This is the library of today. And we are going to, we'll be talking at some point about designing the library of tomorrow, which is what we hope to create at McGill. But these are the sorts of really cool, think of an iPad on that's just as huge as a wall. And that's basically what you have going there. Okay. So what we're talking about here with our second strategic initiative is a major one. Major, major. We know that, I've been saying this for a very long time, almost since I got here, when I struggled with trying to figure out how these spaces fit together and a little bit of the history of our spaces and what our plans were. What we are going to be reimagining McGill as the library of the 21st century by conducting a feasibility study for how we, as a university, can best envision our library system as a whole and what our spaces would look like in concert with what we envision library services as a whole on this campus should be. So that does mean that we have to step back and some of this can be kind of, it's really invigorating to think, what do our users want now? We know that 40% of our regular stack collections haven't circulated in the past 20 years. They're sitting in open stack spaces that, in, as I've said over and over again, on prime real estate in one of the world's most vibrant urban centers at the nexus, at least of this library, which holds most of the volumes, the nexus of McGill and Sherbrooke at one of the truly iconic and emblematic spaces in any of the world's urban centers, at the foothill of a mountain and a heritage site. I mean, you put all that together and it doesn't take very much to realize that maybe what we shouldn't be is having problems hearing? Okay. That we shouldn't be a warehouse, but that we need to use these user spaces for 21st century pedagogy and learning, no matter what that looks like, and to again put ourselves in our users' shoes and try to think of what they need, not what we think they need. And we have been very fortunate in just having the stars finally align with having a provost who's on board with this idea, with a receptive ear, for a new VP for facilities who's familiar with libraries and the needs of libraries, and the Quebec construction requirements, in having the dean's receptive when I talk about the needs of libraries and the needs of users, that they don't immediately say my needs need to come before the library's needs when I remind them that the library's needs are all of their needs, that we don't have a separate group, they are all ours, that all of them are mine, are ours. And so this is something that we're going to be embarking on. The term feasibility study is actually a first step in a formal process for beginning to identify exactly what we would do in terms of library construction needs. So we hope that it's a process that's bid. It will go out globally, so we will be having hopefully architects and architectural firms that will bid on this that are international And so we should be getting some great, great ideas from this. So the executive owner of that is Diane, but everybody and their brother is involved with this as collaborators. The expected outcome is actually to have the feasibility study done by 2014, and we will assess whether we've been successful in this if the best option that comes out of this feasibility study is accepted by the senior administration of McGill University as a priority and moves forward in the master plan, the university's master plan, and hopefully in terms of actually going out and trying to make something happen. So that's hugely important, obviously. The third is actually has a one and a part two. The first is a very general concept of where we're going in terms of re-envisioning and reimagining what services look like writ large in our libraries. And we talk about it as a researching and teaching commons, which is actually a concept that's fairly well understood in a lot of great libraries in North America already. And it's sort of the next, in very simple, if not simplistic terms, it's the next step in an evolution from an information commons, which in a lot of ways we never even went through here. So we're going to have to hop to the evolutionary step of a research commons, implementing what we can on the way to whatever the next version of that is, when we truly re-envision and reimagine our library spaces. Because when we go about thinking of redesigning our library and building, we don't want to build a library of today. We want to be building a library for the next, of the library of 20 years from now. And so, thank you. So that's...
The glass looked clean.
It looked clean. Uh-oh. Okay. Thank you. I really appreciate it. So think when we talk about a research commons, we think in terms of bringing together, again, I'm going to throw this out, but this should not be a list that then draws boundaries around this concept, because it needs to be much broader than that. Great creative minds like yours need to add to this and not just my fumbling through it right now. But we know, for instance, that people come in to our libraries and need help in terms of research support. And research support isn't the traditional library support in terms of let me help you put together a bibliography, or let me help you define your questions so that you don't go about doing research that's already been done. Research support also involves help from the Office of Sponsored Research and knowing how to write a grant proposal and knowing what kind of funding agencies and opportunities there are out there, and actually help them putting together a budget in the sort of very, very programmatic way that you have to for a successful grant application. Part of it, part of successful research is also involved in IT. What sort of support for IT is there? What sort of support can you expect from many, many different places? And libraries should constitute an environment where someone can come and get all the help that they need to do whatever they need. An example in the pedagogical teaching side is the typical housing together of writing centers and libraries now, within libraries, within whether they report to librarians or not. It's very typical for writing centers, which help students write, to be housed cheek by jowl in the same structures with librarians who handle the other side of writing. These are the resources you need. This is how you do citations. This is how you do a systematic search, exhaustive search, or whatever kind of search you need for your project at the time. And then writing center people who actually help people learn how to organize their thoughts and put words on a page in a way that that we need to teach our students and help for faculty. So these are the sorts of things that we know that we need to be thinking in expansive ways and to start to implement these services in collaborative ways with our colleagues on campus so that we begin to forge the future that we will have within these great structures in the future, but that we don't wait for those structures to make these things happen. So it's an evolution that we need to think of. And I know that this is something that we've asked Danielle to take on, and the branch heads in particular as collaborators, because this is thinking that all of our services people, our frontline services people, in a primary way, not uniquely, but in a primary way, because some of our vaccines people need to be thinking about these things too, but they need to grapple with these issues, do some research, talk to people, go visit some places, try to see what's out there in terms of best practices so that we can advance beyond best practices and begin to do it now rather than later. So we've talked about this. What we want is a basic report and beginning to think in terms of implementation of some of these things across all of our libraries. And we hope to have that by December 2015. And very closely related to that as a part of this is doing a good solid look at what our librarians do, our service librarians. I hesitate to use the word liaison librarians, but that's what's been used a lot in re-examining exactly what the role of a liaison librarian is and how we need to expand and be more flexible beyond what some but not all of us view as perhaps a little bit more prescriptive a definition of a liaison model than we want and need into the future. So I think that you'll see some of, in all of these things, I'm hoping that all of these big things came out of, I think, all three of our major planning sessions. So I think that there's nothing here that should be brand new, maybe how the focus or how the words are used may be a little different. Okay, so that's the liaison models I was saying. Those are all part of the same C initiative. D is really important. To improve access to rare and special collections and archives, and actually manuscripts is up there too, that it is, we have the community of research libraries around the world, but particularly in the Western world, particularly in North America, know that we have a big problem with hidden collections. For years and years, we struggled like crazy to keep up with current acquisitions, and we said, we'll just leave the rare books till later, and later is now here. We know that we have real incredible treasure troves in our rare and special collections, and that we need to decide how we want to provide access to those collections appropriately and to go about doing it. It's important for us to start with collection development policies because it's not entirely clear to everyone in the simplest of ways of when we say no. When are we going to say no to someone saying, here's all this wonderful stuff, don't you want it? And we need to be able to have clear enough in our heads to say, no, it's not in our best interest to take that, because we take on an enormous burden when we accept something into our libraries to make it accessible, to house it forever on behalf of the public's trust, and we need to be selective about doing those things. A big part of this is not only cataloging in traditional ways our rare and special collections, but to decide, for instance, what kind of appropriate access mechanisms and descriptive mechanisms are there, should there be, for things such as the Moshe Safdie Architecture Collection, the Richard Pound Olympic Collection, which includes, both of those collections include all sorts of stuff. And we simply have to decide how we're going to handle those things. What's the best way to make them accessible and do it in a systematic way that takes advantage of state-of-the-art best practices in rare books and special collections and archives and manuscripts. Note that that archives is now a part of this hugely. Archives is part of us now, and they have their own special needs, and that is water, and beginning from the beginning and dealing with their issues, water is like water on the sand of the Sahara. They have so many needs, they have so much work to do. They have existed here by the good graces of phenomenal memories of a number of university archivists, and we need to simply get beyond gray matter in terms of access, but some of the tools, 21st century tools that are available to make these things accessible. So that's a major strategic initiative, intention. And finally, well, almost finally, we were struggling with what we want to do in terms of maintaining WorldCat Local and Aleph, but that in and of itself are only words for the larger, more abstract issue of what's the best way now and into the future, to provide access to our users to the collections that we own here, or provide access to through licensed material. And so this is something that came up a lot in our planning initiatives, and I'm going to turn this over to Jen, who's going to talk about it a little bit more so we can ground it a little bit more. I think it's important that she have a little bit of chance to do that.
So if you're looking at the strategic intent document, you'll see there's a footnote to this one. And one of the things the footnote says is that we need to gather more information on exactly what's happening in this landscape. So we came to this decision about kind of sitting pat for a year because the landscape is changing so rapidly. And part of this is really developing and in still very early days. So I'll just point out that when we're talking about the catalog, we're talking about at least two different things. We're talking about the front end that provides user discovery of resources, and we're also talking about the back end that does things like inventory management and circulation. And those are increasingly on two different technologies, even though, you know, kind of the heyday of the ILS meant they were one technology, but we're now looking at two. So our current front end, as you know, is WorldCat Local from OCLC. It's what's known as a discovery layer. So if you've been around libraries for the last 6 or 7 years, you know we've stopped talking about library catalogs for users and we've started talking about discovery layers. And discovery layers tend to have, of course, things in them that are not in the traditional library catalog, notably individual articles, for example, so that you can, you know, be able to search for an individual article title and get to it. That's one of the things the discovery layer tends to do, though perhaps not exclusively. There are vended options where you pay a service provider to license their software. There are also open source options, which means the software is developed and made freely available to use, for anybody to use, but then you have to care and feed it. You have to run it. You have to have technical staff in order to do that. So you spend your money in a different way if you use an open source system. But there are kind of viable alternatives in both categories. What we've seen out there that ARL libraries are doing is that the shift from traditional catalogs to discovery layers is pretty much complete. Only 5 of 115 ARL academic libraries don't use kind of an integrated books and articles search, for example. And the ones that don't kind of look a little retro in kind of current library parlance. The distribution is really interesting, though. If you see if you look at the ARL libraries, you see about a quarter of them use Ex Libris's Primo product. About a quarter of them use Serial Solutions Summon product. If you add together WorldCat Local and the EBSCO Discovery product, that's another quarter. And then the kind of other open source options and a few kind of lingering ones make up the last quarter. So it's really well distributed, and there's no one that's, you know, clearly a leader here. For the back end, the move to new style technologies is far from complete and is in very early days. Traditionally, we talked about ILSs, but now we start talking about web-scale library services platforms. That's the jargon you'll be hearing. So these library services platforms tend to be hosted, run in the cloud, rather than hosted locally, though not always true. Some, but not all of them, are complete rewrites when the same vendor is offering a new product, so starting from scratch. Again, not all. They tend to handle multiple metadata formats. They tend to simplify workflows for doing things that incorporate, say, e-resources much better than the traditional ILS did. They often integrate a knowledge base, though the knowledge base sits kind of in the middle, right? The knowledge base is what has information on all the articles, usually. So they're used for either link resolvers to function, or they're used for to put the articles into this discovery layer. Not all of them do both of those things, but that's kind of what they're for. Here, there are mostly vended options out there, mostly licensed options. There is one open source option called Qawali Olay, which is emerging now. It's going into production at the first two libraries, including one ARL this summer. So that's something we're all closely watching. But it's clear only less than one-fifth of ARLs currently are in production with a library services platform, as opposed to a traditional ILS. So it's very, very early days for that. And the last thing I'll say is that you find something really interesting when you look at who's using what front end compared to their back end. Only 27% of ARL libraries use the same vendor for both of those products, which is a very small number and was extremely surprising to me. This is weighted a little bit by the fact that so many use Summon, and Summon doesn't have a paired back end right now, except that they now have a contract with OCLC to provide WorldShare as a paired back end. So that's probably going to change. And, you know, EBSCO also doesn't have a paired back end. So when you think about the number of libraries that use those, you start to understand why that's a low number. If you look at the libraries that use a traditional ILS, 22% use the same vendor for the front end and back end, so that's really low. But nearly half, 47.6%, that have moved to a web scale solution are using the same vendor. So is that a trend? I don't know. Maybe it's just because it's early days and people are going with the vendor they're comfortable with. Maybe there really is a benefit to that tighter integration. Very, very last thing is, of those that use the same vendor, 85% are all with Ex Libris, which is what we use for Olive now. And I think the reason for this is because they have two ILSs that they run, and they're both widely implemented, and then their web scale product is among the oldest out there. So there's a lot of opportunity for them to have gotten all the customers in that way. So the point of all this is to just give you a sense of how complicated this landscape is and how quickly it's changing right now, to give you context for why we're going to sit tight for a year, but we are going to continue to study this, and we're still working on exactly what mechanisms we're going to put in place to study that. But there we are.
Thank you. I think it's important because this is something that came up, had tons of dots in all of our planning initiatives. And so we really need to be careful about making sure that everyone in the organization, that we communicate with everyone in the organization about what our thinking is and why our thinking is where it is and why, when everything is... when things like this, phenomena like this are so totally diverse across the ARL landscape, that we just kind of need to sit tight. We can afford to sit tight and not be on the bleeding cutting edge and fall off and bleed a lot. I was once on the bleeding cutting edge in terms of technology, and in a system such as this, in a lot of ways, in a very similar time when there wasn't a clear-cut one or two big choices out there that were kind of best practices that you just kind of followed the pack toward. And it was very, very unpleasant, so unpleasant that I've always taken the tack since then of saying, I'm going to wait and see if there's not something that emerges so that we spend an awful lot of time and effort, human resources and monetary resources, in an environment particularly such as McGill's that we cannot afford to do. We're going to let some things coalesce in the environment out there. Okay, if you look at this strategic initiative and you go over and you see expected outcomes and you look at assessment, there are a couple of things going on here. One is that we want to stay abreast of the marketplace and make sure that we know what's going on out there, that we watch movements, that we watch trends. We aren't necessarily going to follow the leader, but we at least want to know who the leader is and the movements. And at the same time, we recognize that while we're in this transition stage that's going to last probably for a long time, it's really important that all of us, to a greater and less extent defined by the needs of our positions, know and are familiar with the systems that we have in place so we can help users optimally. So that means that everybody needs to know, in very simple terms, everybody needs to know how to use WorldCat Local and how to use Aleph, and what's the better way to what, as far as questions go, which system is the best for a given question, and we need to make sure that we provide people with those opportunities to learn and that we monitor to some extent whether you have learned. And so that is why, in terms of assessment for this, we talk about relevant to position and function, all staff, we want staff to attend training sessions, and we want to evaluate at the end of that session whether you feel that you have learned what you need to learn to help people. So this isn't a test, this is a self-assessment. I feel comfortable enough now that I can go out and if I get questions at the desk that I'm going to be able to answer them in the way that I feel comfortable. And so that's an ongoing need through the end of this year and next year. Okay, finally, we have library orientation and mentoring program. This is something that came out really very loudly and very clearly as we are still in this process, which is a multi-year process of institutionalizing our governance structures, our guidelines, our cultural norms and organizational norms for at the moment that you're recruited, that you understand what's required in the organization to succeed, and that you have a path to success outlined, and you get the help that you need to along that path to success through hiring, recruitment, orientation, promotion, tenure, and eventually promotion to full librarian. And so two specific ways to do this that we're going to focus on are orientation for librarians and a mentoring program. So in very simple terms, we're going to be offering librarians who are not yet reappointed, that's the librarians who are newest into the system, a mentor, and then designing an orientation and mentoring process through the next year. Before we go into human resources, I'd like to know, this is your chance for us to have a little discussion on these strategic intentions, clarification, feeling that we, as you know, we followed a process that came from the bottom up, and in terms of dots and importance, these are the directions that were viewed to be the weightiest and those that we feel that we need to advance on to advance the library as a whole in terms of user services over the next 2-3 years. So I invite questions, discussion. Any questions from afar? Nope. We must have been really clear. We've worked really, really, a lot of people have worked very, very hard on making this document and this process be something that we could communicate clearly, verbalize clearly, but also, to the best of our ability, define who was responsible for it, and then to define what we wanted to have happen, and then to be able to tell whether we achieved it. So, yes.
I guess I have a question, and sort of a question and a comment. And it's something I think a lot about. It's something I think a lot about because of things that you've spoken to me about, and to others about, and things that I talk to other people about when I'm out there talking to people about the library. And that it's, McGill is a public institution, and you always talk about in terms of the rare and special materials that we hold them in a public trust, and that we have a tremendous fiduciary responsibility because we're dealing with public funds. And I guess one of the things sometimes, unless I've misunderstood, that we also look at ourselves as a community resource. In other words, our doors are open. Nobody's asked us to show an ID card. Anybody can come in and talk to a librarian. Anybody can sit down with a computer. How does that fit into sort of plans in terms of, in other words, taking an outward view in order to increase attention to what we do? I don't know if I'm being clear.
Yeah, you are. And in terms of a lot of very traditional strategic planning, one of the things that you do is you decide what your audience is. And typically what libraries do, research libraries, is that they say that their immediate audience are the members of the university community.
I understand that.
And then if they're a public institution, they say that they have a responsibility to the local community and then the world at large. And so I'm assuming that that's a value that is understood and imbued in everything that we do. But it's good to remember that. This whole process is rather streamlined, so we don't get into that sort of detail.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, but it's important. Other thoughts? Yes?
Are you going to talk at all about the immediate priorities section?
No, not yet. Next Dean's Corner. Because they kind of go on and on and on and on and on for a while.
Generally.
Oh, well, is there a question about that? So can you add to...
Well, I've already seen some emails that say, because it's on the immediate priorities list, I've already done this. It seems like people are acting on them already.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's okay, isn't it? Yeah. There are a whole lot of tasks in there. Some things which could be done the day after we stop meeting, or were done the day that we were meeting. I mean, there are just things on people's minds that we're just doing. We know we need to get them done. We're moving toward them. We're putting them on the table, recognizing that they're priorities, checking them off.
So if we have questions, we can just ask the executive owner?
Sure. Yeah. 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 And you'll have a chance to do that as a whole with all of them at the next Dean's Corner. We just knew that this was so big, we wanted to divide it rather than exhaustively doing it in one meeting and not giving any part of it due justice. Okay. Nope. Okay, good. Good. I feel good that this is done. It gives us a roadmap. It gives us a 80-90% roadmap. There's 10% which we could never figure out, that we could never predict, that we are still going to attend to as exigencies arise and as they arise. Just because they aren't here doesn't mean that we won't deal with things like $1.8 million budget cuts in the middle of the fiscal year if we have to. So, or floods or whatever acts of God or provinces that happen to happen. So, HR. Yeah.
Good afternoon, everybody. So the month of, since we came back from Christmas in January, we've been busy and had the opportunity to welcome new staff member within new colleagues within our teams and also colleagues in new roles. So in January, Nikki started in USL in a tenure track position of liaison librarian. Nikki, hello again. next week, USL will be welcoming Michael David Miller as the replacement for Jessica, who will be going on her mat leave soon after. In Schulich, Nazi Torabi will be joining the week of March 17, the LIFE team, and Pamela Harrison, who's with us today, Pamela, have joined in January. She's replacing Jill while on a mat leave replacement. And for music was lucky to welcome Taylor just a few weeks ago as the new senior documentation technician. So welcome to McGill, welcome to the libraries. As on what we are working on, the search committee, tomorrow, as you, I'm sure you've seen the announcement, we'll be interviewing our second candidate for the mat leave replacement in Osler. So Dominique Boilly will be joining us tomorrow. We have the job talk at 2:15, so please come and join us. We'll be starting at 2:15 sharp. For the rest of the position that were advertised, well, copy compliance office position is in progress, and we the posting for the documentation technician in music is now closed, and we'll be reviewing the CVs shortly and having interviews in the month of March. For the current and upcoming posting, so we have the position of assistant rare that's still posted and will be up until March 11. And upcoming posting, we will post in the next few weeks the director and university archivist position, a tenure track position for archives, a position of data librarian, another tenure track position, and also a financial administrator within collection services. Last time we spoke last fall, we were talking about the Porter Club century and employees who were celebrating important milestone in 2014. As usual, I have my little gifts. If we can do the honor. My little Berks boxes. So, a big Berks. So David, who celebrated 25 years last year, we have something for you, David. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And back in 2012, we received a pin, a 40 years pin for Madame Gaulin, but unfortunately she was not with us back then, but she has since joined back Schulich and the library. So please, Madame Gaulin. Felicitations.
So that was a great celebration. It's we had a very jolly time. So questions about anything? Yes.
Will the slides be going on the U-Drive?
Yes. Yes, will the slides be going on the U-Drive? Yes.
Little reminder to everyone that staff award nominations are due tomorrow for the librarian and staff. So I encourage everybody to nominate their colleagues. It takes a little bit of effort, but it's something that's really important. That the good work of the members of our community is recognized. So, any other questions about anything? From distance? No, this is okay. Good. I hope it's not that everybody's brain is frozen at the moment. David. Okay. Yes, spring is coming, I promise. Take care. Thank you very much.